Hello, everyone. My name is John Williams, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Institute of Leadership and Management. And I welcome you to our monthly podcast show, Leadership at the Edge, where we share ideas across the community of leadership practice in every context, everywhere. Each month, I'm joined by senior leaders from around the world to discuss their real life experiences, to challenge some of the outdated leadership practices, and to offer a fresh take on the issues that today's leaders face. We invite you to join the conversation via social media using the hashtag Leadership at the Edge, or to send a voice message via the podcast page on Anchor with your questions to our guest. To register for future podcasts and events, visit our website, instituteLM.com, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast series and leave a review. In this episode, we'll be discussing the all-important and ever thought-provoking topic of diversity and inclusion. And I am privileged to have Asif Sadiq, Chief Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Officer at Warner Brothers Discovery, as my guest. Over 20 years, Asif has developed a long and rich career in the diversity and inclusion arena, with senior roles right across the board, previously working for Adidas, City of London Police, and now Warner Brothers Discovery. And he's worked throughout Europe, North and South America, the Middle East, and Asia. Asif is a multi-award-winning expert, being listed as one of the most influential diversity and inclusion leaders globally, and was honoured with an MBE in 2017, credited with bringing high-impact diversity, equity and inclusion activities and programmes to organisations, and ensuring that diversity and inclusion is embedded in all elements of a business. So, who better to share their expert insights and advice on how we can truly be diverse and inclusive in our organizations and in our daily lives? Asif, welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you so much, John.
It's an absolute delight to have you here. And of course, this is, I was going to say a topical subject. It's actually been a topical subject for 20 years, I think, really now. And I guess we're all becoming increasingly familiar with diversity and inclusion principles as that recognition grows around the world of organizations. How familiar do you think we're becoming with the actual practices?
Yeah, so I think it's a fascinating question because, you know, to your point around the 20 years, I think diversity has evolved in those 20 years in itself, right? It's gone from, you know, I can remember diversity being, you know, setting up a stall outside the police station, handing out a few key fobs and balloons, and job done. I think fast forward, you know, to the last couple of years, people have a better understanding of its impact, of getting it right, and what the, you know, the benefits are, consequences are. I think where the challenge lies is that many organizations are fixated on the actions. And right. actions are good, you know, I'm not, you know, dismissing actions, but actions don't drive long-term sustainable change. You know, you really have to start impacting the culture and environment and driving that change. So a lot of companies have done great actions, you know, the one-off things, but they don't last in all honesty. They're a beginning, they're a good starting point. So I think that's where we are within that space, that there is a good understanding, but not necessarily that understanding of, okay, how do we drive this authentically and in a way that it's sustainable, it's weaved into all parts of our business, not just those, you know, corporate statements when you walk into a building saying, hey, we care about diversity and inclusion. I mean, it's good. It's a great starting point again, but what does that mean to me? If I'm joining a team and I'm working somewhere, I want to know, can I bring my authentic self to that team? Am I included? You know, do I belong? Those elements are important. So I think it's a journey, but we've moved along in the 20 years.
That's first of all very, I was going to say reassuring. I mean that in the proper sense of the word, actually, because this is clearly by definition something which is emerging all the time. And I like that one of the words you just used there, which is belong. This idea of ourselves being feeling like we belong actually somewhere. Do you think that, because you mentioned actions can be taken, but it's actually about culture and environment that needs to change. We often think of the culture as being within the people, the environment as being around the people, if you like, or without the people. Is one or other of them either more important or to be addressed first in developing culture or environment that's amenable, really?
I think both go hand in hand, and you know, when we talk about the culture or the environment, I think the critical thing is, how do we create those environments or those cultures that are fluid enough to adapt to those individual unique identities? Now, and what I mean by that, again, is many times when people talk about diversity, it's usually based on what they see.
Yep.
Or a characteristic that they assume is important to you, right? So you walk in and they're like, hey, you know, you're a woman, you're someone from an ethnic minority background or whatever it is. And the assumption is that's the element we need to focus on. That's what your challenges are or where the opportunities lie.
Yep.
Now, you know, again, unique identities, authentic identities mean that we have multiple layers of diversity, intersectionality. And what's important to us shifts. So I think the culture needs to be one of understanding, and the environment actually as well, of understanding that you create a space that is not predefined, but is open to whatever someone brings, whatever that element is, you know. And maybe if I put it as an example, like even with myself, a lot of people talk to me about race. Yeah. So, you know, the last time I checked, I was the same skin color I was when I was born. So I've learned to navigate my race a lot. Not to say I don't face challenges. I still do. You know, there's occasions that I drive in London and the police feel that they must stop me. But generally, I'm very comfortable with my race and how I turn up at work.
Yeah.
But I've got two young kids, and I'm trying to be an active dad, a present father. But no one talks to me about it. It's not one of those things they see. So right. There's no assumption that that's important to me. But for me to feel included, for me to feel like I belong, I have to bring those things that matter to me. You know, I'd rather someone ask me, hey, do you want to leave early because you want to pick your kids up from school?
Yep.
Rather than, hey, we want to put you on a development program because, you know, you're an ethnic minority and you need support. So it's that kind of understanding. And the stereotypes, unfortunately, that run with that as well, right? And that, again, environments create authenticity, which is what we want, not environments where there's assumptions, right? Like, hey, every woman needs more confidence, or, you know, every this. Those things are wrong. They're not, you know, stereotypes we know don't work. So we need to really get to creating environments where it's okay to have those discussions. And just one point on that as well, John, because I think it's an important one. We need to create environments where it's comfortable to have these conversations.
Right.
What I mean by that is there's a lot of fear in the diversity space around saying the wrong thing, offending someone, not asking a question. And my view is we must create learning environments within teams, within organizations, where it's okay to ask something and get it wrong if your intent is positive, right?
Right.
Then we can learn it. I mean, if it comes around, comes across the wrong way and, you know, someone corrects you, it's fine. But what we must not do is not have the conversation because we're too scared, or we don't know what to say, because that doesn't create an environment of inclusion.
Right. That's very interesting. That the point about that being a learning environment, almost by definition, a learning environment is one in which it's okay to make mistakes.
Exactly.
And your key point about intent. The interesting that idea of having a culture which is fluid enough to shift to wherever it needs to be, that sort of makes it feel as though actually diversity and inclusion is almost context sensitive. So and maybe it's not the external context, the environment. It has to be the context we carry with us in our heads, which allows us to flex. Does that sound like it makes sense?
Yeah, that's completely spot on, because I think it is context, right? And it's also context when we think about our working environments, global teams. You know, and it's fascinating, because when you look at it from a global perspective, are we fluid enough in our thinking to adapt to different cultures, different ways, different things that are important? Mm-hmm. And the more and more companies start becoming truly global, you know, it is going to be even more important. And furthermore, you know, we have a tendency sometimes to dominate the world with that, superior cultural perspective, right? Like what we believe in the UK is the right thing, or in the US is the right thing. But we need to understand that it's not about everyone adapting to us. It's about us adapting to others. And let me give you an example. You know, when I talk to our teams in Japan, I know if I speak first, no one's going to disagree with me.
Yep.
So I open the conversation with allowing others to speak first, right? Whereas in the UK, whenever I speak, everyone will disagree with me, right? So it's not a problem. Yes. But it's that adapting to those environments. It's also understanding in other regions what's going to be, you know, what's the best way of getting the best out of our people.
Yep.
But being fluid enough to understand those nuances, differences, and different styles when it comes to creating that inclusive environment.
And that's brings up a really interesting point about our adapting to the diversity of cultures that we will meet out there in the world, because there are more of them than us.
Exactly.
You know, there's nearly 8 billion people in the world, or about 8 billion people in the world. That's exactly. A lot more than John Williams is. So I'm required to adapt and be flexible rather than everybody to adapt and be flexible to me. There's a very important role to be played here by leadership, if I use that leadership figures. Sure. And this is an area where diversity and inclusion is meant to be supported, promoted, and reinforced by leadership figures. Mm-hmm. How do you think we can ensure that that is both doable and actually done?
Yeah, so I think the first biggest thing is it's a lot of leaders almost tearing up the playbook of leadership. And what do I mean by that? When you look at many, many leadership programs, and you know, there's some eminent ones, as you're probably aware, in the US, in the UK, and so on. Amazing programs. I don't want to criticize them, but a lot of them focused on a leader is one who has all the answers, one who doesn't show vulnerability, one who's, you know, that strong male, you know all those traits that we put across.
Yeah.
What the last couple of years have shown us is people engage with leaders who show vulnerability, who don't have all the answers, who are ready to say, "Hey, I make mistakes. I'm human. Show a human side."
Yep.
And I think that's one of the big things in this space that matters. It's not like another business area that you have to get it perfect. But what you do have to do is authentically engage in the conversations. The amount of leaders I speak to are like, "Oh, I can't talk about that because, you know, I know enough." And I'm like, just say it. Say you don't know. No one's expecting you to be an expert on everything. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on every area of diversity. But it's about being transparent, open, and humble in your approach, which people engage with. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, it is important to address D&I in two ways. Of course, one as a business imperative. So you treat it like any other business case, you know, you embed it, you have a project team, all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But at the same time, it's also one of those areas which almost reminds me of, you know, tech many years ago, which initially was 2-3 people, you know, sitting in a closet somewhere, you know, doing a bit of tech. And now tech's a whole sort of business area, right? And it's evolved and we've evolved with the changing nature of it. I see diversity and inclusion in a similar way, right? It's gone from those 2 people looking at policies in HR to now, you know, I mean, if you look at my role, I'm on the board of Warner Brothers Discovery, right? As the chief diversity officer.
Yep.
And that means that even the work within it has evolved. You know, we need to really look at the speed of the rapid growth of it, the innovation that must come with it. How do we weave it into other parts of our business and not leave it in isolation, but also support it in the same way we support other business areas.
Right. Now, very interesting, because that, it, in a sense, identifies diversity and inclusion as a source of competitive advantage, because that's the point of making something a business imperative. And as you say, that requires time, attention, resources, and measurement,
actually,
I guess. So, how do we, because diversity and inclusion is a concept much talked about, and where leaders and managers get, they experience some difficulty propagating the desirable behaviours. If we're going to measure our success in this, how can we improve on how we achieve the things we want to actually get to? How do we measure those things?
Yeah, so I think measurements are in a few ways, right? Like, so when we look at financial gain from a profitability or a customer engagement perspective, those are very clear measures. You know, we know for a fact, let's even just take the buying power of diverse, underrepresented, you know, communities. Huge, huge. You know, when I take a UK example, you know, and if I look at people, let's say, from, you know, if you look at the Black pound and the value of that, or the LGBTQ plus pound, or even you know, people from South Asia. I mean, you know, the amount of money, top 10 richest people, I think 6 of them are South Asian. So the buying power of these communities, you know, wealth has shifted, wealth is changing. So the direct measure there is the engagement with those diverse communities, because that will be easy to measure, you know, how we're reaching out, how profitability is going up. And these things are important, especially as we go into the uncertainty of the next couple of years, companies are going to be fighting for business. And if we have products that are more inclusive of, you know, the disabled community, that's, we're tapping a market that we haven't been able to reach before. So it's rather than trying to churn out more customers from the same sort of, you know, pond we've been fishing in, we need to broaden it. Yep. So that measures direct and we'll see direct results. Mm-hmm. Internally, I think it's fascinating because what is the measure? And many companies focus on measures of representation. Yes. So A percentage of our workforce is female, X percentage of our workforce is, you know, whatever element of diversity. Yep. I think that's a good starting point, mm-hmm. but it's not the only measure. And why I say that is because just because you have representation mm-hmm. doesn't mean those individuals feel included, they belong, because you could have them and you could have a leaky bucket where you're recruiting or you have representation, but they leave and yep. you're just going around in circles. Mm-hmm. So it's important to look at the measures from a measures across the business, so not just as a, you know, not just at entry level, where is yep. representation. Mm-hmm. Also to look at the intersectionality. What about someone who's female, black, has mm-hmm. a disability, is bisexual? Where does that person yep. fall, right? Yep. And also then to understand that, are we losing certain talent more than others? You know, how long does it right. take someone who's white to go from manager to senior manager? How long does it take someone who's black to go from manager to senior manager? And if there's yep. there's a disproportionate time period, we know there's more work that we need to do.
This flags up straight away the importance of data, if I can use that raw word, which I guess is the foundation of our understanding of what's actually happening in organizations. Is there a sort of is understanding and utilizing data potentially a sort of universally satisfactory way to develop inclusive practices in organizations, do you think?
I think so. The challenge sometimes is, and you know, I speak to many companies and many people talk about, well, you know, we don't have data, we can't collect data there, we don't have this data. True. I mean, there's legal restrictions in certain countries around what you can, can't collect. Yep. Some companies have data on their staff, some don't. The thing is, there is no company out there that doesn't have some data. It's right. about how can we utilize the data we have if we don't have specific diversity data, mm-hmm. you know, and it's starting to look at that. And it just means looking outside the box, you know, back to what we were discussing initially, thinking of what's the other ways we can utilize data? What are the measurements we can put in place? You know, if we're more risk averse and we don't want to collect diversity data, what can we look at? Right. Certain things like gender is one of those universal pieces that we can collect. So maybe that's a starting point, because even, and I say this quite often in this space, even if we focus on an element of diversity, a win within one element is a win for everyone because we improve a process. Right. So if we improve something around, you know, looking at gender equity around our recruitment, if we improve a system, it will probably benefit the other diverse underrepresented groups as well.
Yep, excellent. That's really a neat encapsulation of a way to get a holistic solution from what is actually almost a narrowly focused activity or action. Exactly. Yeah, by extrapolating. Just extending it beyond organizations, how do you think, or is this even possible, organizations which are exemplary in their inclusive behavior can be encouraged and supported in spreading that message to, for example, their supply chain or their peers?
I mean, yeah, really good question. I think, you know, I mean, firstly, I don't think there's any organization who's perfect in this. There's organizations who do some great things, including ourselves, but we're not perfect. And you know, I think that acknowledgement, firstly, is a huge piece, that there's always a journey. There's no end point in this journey, right? That it's going to be continuous for many years to come. I think the point you mentioned there is actually a really powerful one, because we can also create supply diversity, whether that's trying to bring in more diverse suppliers or the suppliers we have, using our influence to get them to create more inclusion, diversity within their organizations. Because we have the power. You know, even if you look at a company like ours, we have some huge contracts. If we were to tell one of our suppliers, we need this, they will do it, right? Because it's a huge contract for them.
Yep.
And then the other part of this is, so there's the supplier piece of, you know, what's coming in, but there's also the piece of what we do, right? We can influence customers we work with. So big corporates who work with other corporates, you know, how do we influence them to start thinking about diversity? And the humble part of this equation is, there will be companies that we're better than, and there'll be companies that are better than us.
Yes.
But we need to create a relationship where if we're working with a partner, a business, who's better than us, we say, hey, do you know, amazing, you do this great, let's learn from you. Or where we're doing something better, we say, hey, we do this really well, let's share with you. Because diversity isn't one of those things, or you know, the work in this space, we don't need to keep it a secret. We can share it with others, we can grow, we can learn, and we can work together. And that's the influence we have. And, you know, I remember going back many, many years when I used to work for a consultancy, one of the big consultancies. And I remember, you know, those days when it was engaging with clients, it was all about, you know, taking them out to fancy restaurants, drinks, that kind of stuff. And I remember when I left, which was probably got about 10 odd years ago, clients started saying, well, we don't want to do the fancy restaurants and drinking. What we want to do is let's do an event on neurodiversity. Let's do something on this. And I was like, wow. So now the clients want us to, and it was starting to shift. And I've seen that shift more and more and more over the years, where clients, partners are asking more of the people they work with, because they're being held to account by their customers, by their staff.
Yep.
So it's having this knock-on effect.
Very interesting. Two things you've said in that, which were really, really stood out for me. One is that diversity and inclusion is not a state of grace. Not something we arrive at and we mop our fevered brow and say, well, we made it now. Thanks very much. And it's that never-ending journey. The other thing is, it's not a zero-sum game. If we share success, we do not lose anything by doing that. In fact, actually, I guess we gain if our peers and suppliers and everybody else. That's very powerful indeed. So I'm thinking about, it, inevitably, in a conversation like this, there's going to be a top tip question. So what would be your top tip for organizations wanting to foster and embed inclusivity as part of their organizational culture?
Yeah, so there's probably two big things. One is we need to start getting comfortable being uncomfortable, right? Because it is uncomfortable. This conversation is uncomfortable. But we need to get over that fear of it. We just need to get to that stage. The second piece is, many organizations wait for that perfect moment, right? They want to get it exactly right, get it exactly perfect before they do something in the D&I space, whether it's a program or initiative and so on. My view is, it's not about the perfect moment. It's about making every moment, you know, count and make it perfect. And what I mean by that is doing something and getting it wrong is not bad. We can learn and do it again. I'd rather do it seven times, get it wrong seven times, and learn each time and improve the process, and then get it perfect on the eighth time, rather than wait for that perfect moment and never arrive there.
Right. Excellent. So actually, in a way, there almost isn't any such thing as perfectly right. And yet wrong is just a learning experience.
Exactly. But it's an initiative. It's trying. It's that whole piece of that you tried, right? Like, if we ran an initiative and it didn't have the successes that we expected, we've still done something positive in this space.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. As long as we learn and say, okay, if we did this, or we changed that, or we adapted that, it would make it perfect. But it gives us that real sort of lived experience of doing it and learning from it. But yeah, and I think that piece is big. Actually, and there's a third thing as well, which I'd probably add there as well. Which is, many times I hear organizations saying, what are our competitors doing? You know, what is others in our industry doing? And my view on that is, why do you want to be the best of a bad bunch? You know, you have to look at yourself. No two cultures and no two companies, even in the same industry, are the same.
Yeah.
You need to look inwards, not outwards, and try to understand, what are the changes that will work for you? Some companies might need to do 10 things. For you, it might be one thing. And it might be a slightly different thing to what the other companies are doing. But, you know, it is important that you reflect on what matters to you. Speak to your staff, speak to your leaders. Really get that conversation going around what people want to see, not what you think people want to see because others are doing it.
Brilliant. Absolutely. But that it does require very clearly a courage, both at the individual and at the corporate level, that is almost anathema to ordinary business practice in a way, because it's being courageous in areas that people have not been familiar with in the past, and which I guess is why it's not easy, actually.
Exactly.
The fact it's not easy shouldn't be a barrier to trying it, I think. Asif, this has been a tremendous conversation, and I'm sure that we could have several more conversations about this, and certainly for the next 20 years, I would think, really.
But
the things I will take away from this are the things that I just mentioned, actually, which are really, really, I think, incredibly powerful. This idea that there's no state of grace to be achieved here. We just have to keep, in a sense, retaining that courage to be authentic. And then actually, it's not a zero-sum game. We are what we share, and actually we all benefit from sharing success. Asif, I am absolutely delighted with our conversation, and I'm sure that our listeners will be as well. That's it, everybody. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. My special thanks to our guest, Asif Sadiq, MBE, and to you, the audience, for listening. Please do join the conversation via social media using the hashtag #LeadershipAtTheEdge, or send a voice message via the podcast page on Anchor. And for more of our podcasts and events and lots of other content, visit our website at www.instituteLM.com. Subscribe to the podcast series, leave a review, and mention us to your colleagues. Thank you, everyone, for listening.